The Farm in the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot Bioproven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. Our focus this week is weed control. We are still waiting for fields to dry in our area to get a sprayer in the fields, let alone a planter. Jason Wierig provides the latest tips and trends in spring weed control. And in the back half of our show, it's a hemp production update from a longtime producer of the crop. It's all on this edition of Farming the Countryside. We like to do fall spraying on our fields, especially those fields going to corn the following season. In our area, henbit can overtake a field, and even if you kill it with burndown, it can create quite a mess to plant in. But last year's late season meant we didn't get any of that spraying done, so we've got to control everything, hopefully early this spring. Dr. Jason Wierig has been a guest on this show in the past and is an expert in the area of weed control. We also talk about a subject that I hear bantered about quite a bit, and that's the use of fungicide. Do you need it, even if you don't see much disease pressure? We cover several topics to get us ready for the season.
Dr. Jason Wierig joins me from MFA. And Jason, we visit every once in a while, and it's kind of that time of year again with weed control. Why don't I start here? 2019, we had a lot of acres that weren't planted, and those that were planted probably were planted late. How does that impact weed control going into 2020 as you see it?
You know, Andrew, as we've talked before, the weed and seed bank is very crucial in the determination on the types of herbicides and the herbicide program we're going to go to the field with. And, you know, coming out of 2019 with the prevent plant and those late planted crops, we saw several producers cut back on the herbicide program in 2019, which led to not only in the planted fields, but the non-planted fields, an increase in weeds and weed presence in that field. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, those fields did set seed. And so we're going to have to deal with the headaches of not controlling those weeds in the 2019 growing season. I will say, as we jump into the 2020 season, I look outside and try to get a herbicide plan together. We're losing some window here as we get in ready to start planting. And I guess a word of encouragement would be to control those weeds prior to putting the crop in the ground to make sure that we have a plan in place to control some of those problematic weeds, whether it be mare's tail, giant ragweed, common ragweed, those type of weeds, that we control those for sure prior to emergence of the crop, corn or beans, but prior to putting them in the ground, as our herbicide options are very limited from that point forward.
Do you think that the fact that we may have more weeds because we had more seed from 2019 and in a lot of places, does that change the timing? Does that change what I'm going to want to look to put on my field at all? Or is it just we may just have more weeds out there to kill?
Well, I think it's a multitude of things, to be quite honest with you. I think from a standpoint of weeds getting size, they're starting to gain some size on us. And we know as they gain size, one, we have to look at changing our herbicide program, maybe going from a straight growth regulator 2,4-D application to maybe going to a Liberty Gramoxone type application with some contact burner out there, Sharpen type products, to make sure we get a good kill on these bigger weeds. They are going to be starting to get some size on them. They are bolting out there. So changing the herbicide plan based off the weed spectrum that's out there, like I said, to make sure that we control them prior to coming up. I do think that we will see a shift. I think that, you know, we look at some of the new technologies and traits that are out there. It does allow for a little bit more flexibility on that preseason application closer to that planting window. So whether that be with the extend trait or the enlist trait, we do have the flexibility to go closer to planting with those herbicide technologies.
You kind of went where I wanted to go. Are there new technologies that you see in 2020 that a lot of producers are going to switch to, or they should just be aware of that maybe we didn't have last year or in years past?
You know, I look at that herbicide trait technology and the bean side of things, soybean side of things, and it's a very changing dynamic or changing landscape, if you will. I look at the enlist trait going to be making a heavy switch into our area, a heavy movement into our area. Most of those acres from what we're hearing or seeing is a switch from the straight Liberty. So with the Enlist trait, we're able to spray the Enlist herbicide from Corteva, as well as Liberty from BASF, those type of products, to be able to control with the growth regulator as well as the contact herbicide. So we're seeing a shift from those straight Liberty acres to the Enlist trait. And, you know, I think we're still going to see a flat market on the Xtend trait this year as we look forward. We are anticipating XtendFlex approval, hopefully, in normal conditions soon, you know, by midsummer, hopefully. So XtendFlex is coming, not currently on the market. So as we look at that trait, and you look at the Enlist trait specifically, I think we've been using 2,4-D in a burn down, albeit at a reduced rate or a less pounds per acre. We've seen some issues as those weeds start to get bigger. And you're going to see those same issues with Xtendimax or with Enlist. As that mare's tail and giant ragweed start to bolt, we have to make sure that we're getting good coverage, we're using the proper adjuvants in the tank, and that we may have to change it up a little bit based off the weed size that's out there. And obviously, it's not going to be a silver bullet, but it does give us another option as we look at planting our soybeans.
Dicamba, of course, has been around now for quite a while, but we've had some recent court cases, and I think these types of things are always on people's minds. Do you see that changing at all, the landscape of what people are spraying, or any recommendations that people have on using that?
Well, Andrew, as you know, I've been a pretty I'm a supporter of the Xtend trait and the Dicamba platform on the soybean side of things. From my university days when I was at the University of Missouri, and from there, we've been promoting the dicamba portion of that. Is really the fit for the Xtend trait is in this burn down situation. That's where it shines. It shines on the giant ragweed. It shines on the mare's tail with the dicamba trait. And that's where I've always positioned that, tried to position that as a burn down early season application on soybeans. Those late season applications, you know, at MFA, we've tried to be good stewards of that product. We've set our own cutoff dates. We've stopped spraying when some of our competitors did not, just due to the inherent risk of those off-target movements. I do think that we're going to see, you know, like I said, I mentioned a flat, as far as acres in our geography, they're going to be flat. That'll be the first year that they're not going to be up, just in my opinion, that we'll see those acres stay consistent to where they were last year. So I think we'll see some people change, maybe some of the way that they do things with the recent court cases that you see out there. But as far as MFA, we're going to continue to try to be the best stewards of the products, not only Xtendimax, but all the products that are out there. We try to be good stewards of those.
Sure. You know, I think we all want to be good stewards. And on that topic, you see a lot of producers, because you're working with them all the time. What are some of the things in general that we probably need to think about more that, you know, maybe we don't think about enough? I think all of us want to be good stewards, but what things are you seeing out there that we kind of need to keep in mind?
Well, I guess some of the things that I would keep in mind is being neighborly. You know, I grew up on a farm, and we always used to stop in the middle of the county road and talk to our neighbors. And you know, I'd always ask my granddad, why are we stopping here and talking for 30 minutes to our neighbors? Well, that's just part of it. And then I think we've lost a little bit of that as we look at some of these farms and generation gaps. Do we know what that neighbor has planted across the fence? We have those communications, open communications. That'd be the first step I'd have is being neighborly, talking to those guys, trying to figure out, get a game plan for what we control options are out there, what their plans are, and as well as inform them what your trait that you're going to have in your field. I think as far as application, I think that it's important to understand that soybeans are ultra sensitive to dicamba. And, you know, we've done some research with the University of Missouri, with Bayer, looking at some off-target movement. And I guess I would just caution you to say, we're able to see dicamba move. That doesn't mean other herbicides aren't moving as well. So I think that it's just a good practice to make sure we're using the correct tips, make sure that we're using the correct water. And, you know, we're using the correct speed and we're going across that field. That those are all important factors that we have to keep in mind. One thing I do like to talk about is boom height. And I see this quite a bit. And when I see a sprayer where I'm driving down the road, my wife will, I'll pull over on the side road. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I want to take a picture of this sprayer going across the field. The boom may be 6-7 feet above the field. And I get that from a standpoint of sitting in a sprayer and running one. But our target height is at 18 to 20 inches above that crop. I know that's tough. You know, you look at some of our areas where we have grassback terraces or rolling hills, that's tough to do and to manage that. But there are some systems out there that we can put on our sprayers that help us with that boom height placement to keep that boom height at the correct height. You know, the higher you put that boom up, you'll be 10, 12 feet off the ground. If you look at a guy going across the hill and the tip of the boom comes across the crest of that hill, we can cause a lot of issues, and the herbicide has the potential to move a long ways at that point. So proper boom heights would be one of the things, Andrew, we probably don't talk enough about.
I agree. Well, as a guy that has terraces like myself, I think about that a lot. You try to keep close to the ground, and it's sometimes hard, but you know that you need to. It's just important to do it. Hey, let's talk for a moment. No-till, any special considerations this year with no-till for those that are in that type of tillage or non-tillage, I guess you'd say, system?
Yeah, I think it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, Andrew. I think it's very important that we control these weeds or have a game plan to control the weeds prior to planting the crop, especially in a tillage in a no-till situation where we don't want to come in there and clean up those middles with a tillage pass or equipment. I think that, you know, there are some options out there. You know, when you look at Sharpen, you think of Extendimax, you think of Enlist. There's lots of options out there for a producer. I think we're going to see maybe even an option for Liberty on the burn down side of things. But again, I'll caution you that we're exposing those weeds to Liberty, and then doing it again in season, we have a potential to cause some resistance issues there as well. But my word of caution to anybody, tillage or no-till, is to make sure that we control those problematic weeds prior to planting the crop. If we do not, our options are very, very limited.
This could be a topic or a show in itself, fungicide. You know, as we move through the season, we think about fungicide, and I know a lot of producers out there, sometimes it becomes more of a decision of, well, how's the crop look and how's the price look, which probably we need to take more things into account. But just general, talk about that. We may circle back around to it in a later show, but what should we be thinking about as fungicide as we get ready to go out in fields right now and plant a crop?
Man, I tell you, that's an interesting topic. It always comes up as far as fungicide and what you're going to see. And I'd love to sit here and tell you I have a crystal bullet and or a crystal ball and can tell you that you're going to see an X response to a fungicide. I can tell you from our trials last year, Andrew, we saw a 6 to 7 bushel increase on soybeans from the fungicide, and that was in the absence of disease across a 3-4 to a 5-0 soybean. And we saw a 21 to 22 bushel increase on corn. And we did have a little bit of northern corn leaf blight and some gray leaf spot, but it really was nothing as far as heavy disease presence. We didn't see that. So from a plant health standpoint, I'll take from a plant health standpoint, we see those responses year in and year out, that we see those responses enough to cover and make money on for the producer. Now, that one year that you see a no significant yield increase, what we've seen is you see that 1 or 2 years in 10 years that you may not do that. Now, if I look at an agronomy standpoint, I'll put on my agronomy hat here for you, and I worry about resistance. I just talked about it on the weed side. We want to make sure that we're using multiple modes of action. So we know we look at an SDHI, Astrovi, Trizol, those type products. We want to make sure that we have multiple modes of action. We go out there to look at diseases as well. We know we've got some frog eye issues with some of the Trizols. We know that those issues exist, and we have to manage resistance not only in herbicides, but also in fungicides and insecticides. So I guess and you bring up a good point there, when it comes down to that season, everybody's always looking at the weather, or they got a banker that's saying, hey, you know, we're done for the year. But ultimately, those could be one of the highest return on investments that we've seen on, you know, 8 out of 10 years.
Well, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but from what you were saying there, I think in some places you said that you didn't see much disease, but you still did it and had a response. Do you find that is the case a lot of times, that, yeah, we want to be scouting and looking at things, but in some cases it's important to do it even if I don't see much disease because I'm still gaining. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And the data would lean towards that way, not only from our data, but university data as well as company-owned data. So that is something we've seen on the plant health side of things. It helps make that plant more efficient. Yeah, it's something we see year in and year out.
And you think maybe up to eight out of every 10 years, maybe?
Yeah, that's kind of what the general rule of thumb is. There are some years out there where we don't see a response. I'm just being honest with you. We just, there could be a lot of factors that could be limiting other than what the fungicide might bring us. There's a lot of factors that affect our crops. Could be nitrogen, could be a micro. But if everything's looking good and we have a potential for a good crop, we see a good response. Now, if you have disease, if you have insects or something else limiting you, it's obviously not going to help you with that. But when we have a good crop, good healthy crop, we do see those responses out there.
Another thing, again, we could spend a whole show on, but quickly, you know, a lot of the nitrogen has gone on as anhydrous already. Some people may have some starter, but anything I should be thinking about is fertility once I have this crop in as I'm moving through the season.
Yeah, I think if you think about the nitrogen's already been put on, We've had significant rain again this year, kind of like we did last year, and it looks like it's going to continue for the next couple of weeks. We've got to make sure that our nitrogen is there for our crop. We saw an exceptional response to our in-season applications of nitrogen with ammonium sulfate last year, whether it be a super U or urea coated with MBPT or a stabilizer. We saw exceptional results doing that. What we like to look at, and as being good stewards of our nitrogen, is looking at NDVI maps, aerial imagery, using drone flights, and then also using our InAdvisor tool that we have, that we're looking at nitrogen loss by soil type, by rain or environment, and creating those VRT recs based off soil type. And what kind of factors can we put into a model that will influence that? So, yes, nitrogen management is going to be crucial again this year, especially if you had your nitrogen on and didn't put a stabilizer on there. You may want to be looking at that and see what you guys got to be doing.
Thanks to Jason for once again taking time to visit with us. I always appreciate his agronomy insights. We need to take a break. Our Farm in the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Everyone knows that plants need nitrogen to grow, and now there's a way to make sure corn plants have the nitrogen they need every day. Synthetic nitrogen is susceptible to loss, and applying mid-season can be time-consuming and costly if you can get in the field at all. Pivot BioProven's nitrogen-producing microbes bond tightly to corn roots, transferring ammonia to the corn plant each day. Unlike synthetic nitrogen, Pivot BioProven is not washed away, making crop yields more productive and more predictable. Pivot BioProven, nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. I first introduced you to Michael Bowman on this show about a year ago. Michael and his family have farmed for decades in eastern Colorado. If you've heard him speak, it's most likely been a result of him growing hemp for several years on his farm. I recently visited with Michael, and we talked about the latest news in the hemp industry, as changes in the laws are now making this a viable option on many farms. He also provides his take on the long-term future of the industry and his tips on how farmers can get started growing the crop. Michael, we are about a year now past the 2018 Farm Bill. You've had hemp now, how many years on your farm? You've been growing it for quite a while, though.
6 years, and most of the pioneers in Colorado has also completed their sixth year of growing in Colorado.
What initially drew you to the crop to begin planting hemp?
Well, I was sitting around a campfire in Zimbabwe 20 years ago this month, and we started a conversation about crops that were grown in India, and it was in that particular conversation, and we talked about hemp and something I didn't know much about at the time, and got interested in it because of what I was discovering about the plant. And of course, I grew up on a farm, was working actively on the farm at that time, but we were too far west to have ever had it as a crop, and. So I started studying the crop, and then got slightly obsessed, both for the opportunities that plant might bring for value-added opportunities, but then in our particular case, being a farm over the Ogallala Aquifer, very concerned about our water use and just looking for alternatives to something that used less water and would still bring us new opportunities to our small community.
Many countries have never outlawed this. Does that mean that we don't have to look far to get what we need, or is this a whole new thing for us?
Well, we're really starting from scratch again, because generally speaking, we don't as a country and a government, we don't recognize research that's been done outside of the U.S. So although that research exists, we're really starting from scratch with our own institutions again, although we can rely and be informed by what's going on out there, and at least we know what the opportunities are. That we're in a real fun time now where we can start marrying up these educational resources and the land-grant universities with farmers again and really, really take this to a whole new level.
Do you think what will become of the hemp industry in the U.S. is different than what it has been in other countries? Are other countries having different end uses than we will have, or how do they compare to what other countries have been doing?
Well, what I'm so excited about this is, you know, there's no better entrepreneur and no better innovator than the American farmer. And because this plant can be so many things, I really think that once we're not, you know, we're only limited by our imagination right now and how we, you know, how can we develop products. And I do believe that we will be a major market player in the global markets with all of the things that we can develop from this plant here now over time. It took a foundation of some education now. Now we need some infrastructure and partnerships and organizations that can lead. But I have no doubt that the U.S. farmer will command a significant presence in the global markets on this soon.
because it's a new industry, how do you begin to have all the infrastructure to be able to handle it and process it and so forth? How does that begin to develop, or do you see it, it's really coming on very fast?
Well, this is really a chicken and egg story again, right? We know we have farmers who want to grow it. We need the end markets. This is a real, I think, appropriate time for the government programs that exist and have been developed before for, like, the BCAP program and things that were to get farmers to grow for the, you know, the ethanol industry at one time. We've done this before for other industries in agriculture, and so I think there'll be some real appropriate places for us to talk about policy that, you know, that solves the chicken and egg problems. And now that hemp has officially been descheduled, and we have access to all the USDA rural development and Small Business Administration programs, they're going to open up an opportunity for us to start really focusing on those infrastructure needs and how we get there.
On your farm, what have you been growing the crop for? Has it been for the oil side, the industrial use? What do you have for an end user?
Well, we've got almost exclusively for oil. Okay. We've now branched out into grain, and in 2020 we'll have a pretty significant focus on grain. We'd like to look at the food opportunities and the feed opportunities from that side of the spectrum. But the CBD market and the oil market has really driven it to, you know, got us to this point. We owe that to that market. But there's 24,999 other things we can do now.
I'm glad you mentioned grain and feed. Talk about those for a moment. What are the opportunities there? Because sometimes they get overlooked because we tend to focus a lot on the oil side.
Yeah. Well, the extraction of the hemp oil, now that's different from the CBD oil, but the hemp oil that comes from the seed of that plant leaves us the two products. The oil itself, which is an incredible oil for both fuel and bioproducts. Sherwin-Williams uses as the base for all of their oils pre-1937. It's a wonderful oil for that. But that seed cake that's left is high in protein and fiber and an amino acid profile that is uniquely suited for, you know, we think for animal feed. We know that Kansas State had briefly studied this for aquaculture and fish 25 years ago before they were stopped by the federal government for using a drug. And I use air quotes around that. So I know that Senator Cochran, when I was in the early days of looking for support for the Industrial Hemp Farming Act, you know, pre the 2018 Farm Bill, he had an extreme interest in how to, further support their tilapia industry in Mississippi as an example. So if we have other sources of protein, and the consumers, you know, are really kind of reaching out and looking for new opportunities in the protein space. Both I tell you, I've fielded probably a half a dozen calls over the last 4 years from egg producers. Mostly kind of mid-range egg producers who have said, you know, we'd like a market niche. We'd like to be able to talk about, you know, an enhanced omega in the egg or healthier chickens. There's research out of Australia that indicates that the chickens fed, you know, the hemp protein have lower mortality rates. So, you know, they're thinking about marketing and how they carve out a niche in the marketplace, you know, hemp-fed eggs is one of the things they're looking at. So it just as an example, and I think we've had trials going on in Colorado with beef now, and there's trials going on in Kentucky as well. So I think we're just starting to really kind of understand and grasp the opportunity for just a companion protein.
Do you foresee a time when right now we have byproducts from corn and beans, and we use that extensively in feeding? Is that where we'll be with hemp before long?
Yes, I do. I think it'll travel a very similar path where we'll have, that'll be part of it. We can make fuel and then have protein as well. So much like the soybean plant and corn as well. So I think very similar paths and just, you know, different product, but hopefully we can make more products with the things that are left once we've created the primary product.
You talk about the path, and you've been on this path for quite a while. You know as much as anybody in this industry, I think. So take me down the road 10 or 20 years. Is hemp then just another commodity like corn and beans, or will it be a specialty all the time? Where are we headed with it?
I think it's got the opportunity to be another commodity. You know, I think that's a long-range view to do something of that nature. We've been 30 years building a soybean market, so this isn't something that's going to happen overnight. But I do think this has the opportunity to be a legitimate third crop at some point yet, I think, in my lifetime, I hope. where it's just another rotation. It's another opportunity to integrate something into our farm rotations that are just going to provide some more revenue opportunities.
For farmers that are looking at it, it seems like right now there's still a lot of unknowns and ups and downs. So is it a good time to get in because now is a time when, boy, if I know what I'm doing, I can make some money? Or is it a better time to, well, let's wait and see and the market get established so I don't have as much risk?
Well, there's a little bit of both. I would say to any farmer that wants to try, go out and try something on a small scale. You know, try 5 acres. Go out and, you know, and play with it. Understand it. Don't invest anything more in it than you want to lose right now. But I do think it's a good time to, you know, dip your toe in the water. It all kind of boils down to your risk profile and you know what you're comfortable with. Those of us, you know, when you look at it from a Colorado perspective, we're in a year six. So we have different ideas thoughts about risk than somebody who might be planting their first crop in Indiana or Ohio or somewhere in the Midwest. So different challenges, but they're fun. It's exciting, and we really look forward to a day when we've brought the industry to where it's on par with everything. We have, you know, a true multi-peril crop insurance product. When we have banking comfortable. When we have commodity trading platforms for it. So we'll get there. And with this formation of the U.S. Hemp Growers Association, we'll be really focused on those facets of that. They're going to bring us into the mainstream.
Well, the association certainly should help with the education and being able to kind of bring things together so it isn't so much of a scattered type of approach, I'd think.
Yeah, you know, we're right. If we really want to make this a legitimate third crop of the United States, our community has to be those that are in the effectively in the corn, soybean, cotton space now. We think that we can help foster that education, those research opportunities, those policy issues that we're going to have on Capitol Hill. What's good for farmers? You know, that we need that farmers, the true farmers' voice on Capitol Hill about what do we need in policy to get it to make this a vibrant industry. So we think USHDA will be a good vehicle for that.
We will check in with Michael later in the season to see how this year's hemp crop is performing and get the latest on this maturing industry. Before we conclude this week's show, I do hope you'll connect with us for story ideas, especially in this time with so much going on in our world. I'm trying to find a balance to continue to provide content that we need in the agricultural world and also focus on some of the subjects that have leapt to the forefront with the COVID-19 crisis and its effect on our families, our industry, and our world. And as we move into the planting season, I'm reminded of the two things my father always says to each of us when we head to the field. Take your time and be safe. He's planted corn and beans for over 7 decades, and even with the storm approaching, both literal and figurative, his words of taking time and being safe are important. They go right along with his advice for moving cattle, which is the fastest way to move cattle is slow. So be safe, be patient, and enjoy the spring season. It certainly will be a different one for us this year. Perhaps you're like me and have some extra help around the farm right now with kids who are at home. I know we've made time for more tractor driving, horseback riding, and other farm lessons with the family. Those are special times to enjoy. We'll be back next week with another edition of Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.